Last 5% Media.
On this podcast, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. In addition, historical audio and original interviews include outdated language to describe sex workers. Listener discretion is advised.
There were only 5,000 of us. There were very few Americans because you had to speak a second language and you pretty much had to have gone to college.
This is Penny Stanley. She worked many years as a flight attendant with Pan American World Airways, a company with strict attention to standards at every level, from mechanical systems to appearances.
The weight thing was really tight, 100, 112 pounds, you know, for 5'3".
For decades, Pan Am was the most prestigious airline in the world. At its peak, its jets serviced 86 countries and carried 11 million passengers a year.
I was 33. I loved my job. If you speak to most Pan Am flight attendants, we loved our job. It was very glamorous.
Penny shared a photo from that era of elegant first-class travel.
Would you like to have these? These are all the newspapers.
A red and navy blue apron covers her uniform blouse, and she's rolled up her sleeves as she serves New York strip steak and haricot vert, green beans. She's wearing silver eyeshadow, it's the 80s, and discreet gold jewelry. Four decades later, Penny has the same bright smile as the 30-something flight attendant in the photo.
Our uniforms are Armani. You get pearls from Dior at Christmas. It was very glamorous.
On November 16th, 1981, Penny arrived at the Criminal Courts Building in downtown Los Angeles.
There were just hundreds of people. Hundreds of people.
She was one of 360 potential jurors for the murder trial of Angelo Bono.
And then finally, they called my name and then asked questions, and I remember being quite confused as to what they were asking about this trial. I still didn't know what was going on after about 2 or 3 days of sitting there, because I had been out of the country when these murders at that time were going on.
Prosecutors and defense lawyers couldn't believe Penny knew almost nothing about the Hillside Strangler case. Because her job frequently took her out of town before news traveled on the internet, she missed the saturation coverage of the Hillside Strangler murders in 1977 and 1978, and the arrests of Kenneth Bianchi and his cousin Angelo Bono the following year.
I kept saying, I lived on airplanes. I was going around the world. And at that
For 14 time, weeks, Penny watched as prosecutors and defense lawyers took turns questioning potential jurors.
And I just sat there and sat there day after day as they whittled it down.
Finally, on February 26th, 1982, it was done.
And I remember that when they closed the jury, I think I was the only one that was in shock and extremely upset. But I couldn't get off at that point. I was sort of locked in. I burst into tears.
A jury of 12 men and women, plus another 8 alternates, would decide Angelo Bono's fate.
My name is Penny Stanley, and I was juror number 1 in the Hillside Strangler trial.
I'm Joseph Rodota. I first encountered the Hillside Strangler case 30 years ago in my former career as a political opposition researcher. In this podcast, I revisit 10 homicides that terrorized Los Angeles in 1977 and 1978, and the longest murder trial in U.S. history.
Where they had taped her, they had untaped her. And there was all kinds of fibers in that tape left on her hands.
But I looked at him really hard, and I just felt icy cold.
She should have been at home being a mom and not partying or running the streets.
Oh, I don't think either of us knew what was ahead.
From Last 5% Media, this is Hillside. Chapter 7, Spokes on a Wheel.
This binder here I was pulling out is just exhibits.
This is Roger Boren. As a deputy attorney general, he led the prosecution of Angelo Bono. I interviewed Boren at his home in Southern California.
I put them all in one binder. Originally at trial, we had it in different things. It includes some copies of documents.
On the first day of March 1982, a clerk swore in the jury and Roger Boren addressed them for the first time. Jim Mitchell was in the courtroom that day, reporting for the local CBS-TV affiliate.
Today, the prosecutor began presenting his case to the jury, telling them how the victims were abducted, how their nude bodies were found, most of them on hillsides.
Much of the case against Angela Bono relied upon the testimony of his cousin, Kenneth Bianchi. Prosecutor Roger Boren explains.
He was not our star witness, but he was a key witness. A star witness implies that, you know, this is the guy that's going to tell you everything you know. He was a key witness because without him, it wouldn't have held together, because you couldn't give a structure to what happened.
To guide the jury through this massive, complex, hard-to-understand case, Boren prepared two charts.
But basically, each chart had 12 items. And one was things that corroborate Bianchi, that he's telling the truth.
Bianchi had changed his story multiple times, altering key details about a crime or claiming he couldn't remember what happened. So Boren focused the jury's attention on a specific set of Bianchi's statements and the evidence that matched.
And we organized all of our argument falling under one of those 12 items. Some way you could argue everything in it.
But Kenneth Bianchi had already confessed his role in the murders. So Boren's second chart was a roadmap to the evidence against the man on trial, Angela Bono.
It was basically items that connect Bono to the murders independent of Bianchi. And we had 12 items there. And
there really were four pieces, and this is how I argued the case to the jury.
This is Mike Nash, Boren's co-prosecutor in the Hillside Strangler case.
Number one, we'll show you that the murders were all similar, which leads to the conclusion that they were committed by the same person or persons. Okay. Secondly, that there was evidence to suggest that there were two people.
The Hillside Strangler's fifth and sixth victims were two middle school students abducted after they got off a bus one night, not far from home. The prosecutors believed it was unlikely one man could have killed them both at the same time.
You know, kind of hard for one guy with two girls.
Physical evidence also suggested that more than one person was responsible for these murders.
Where there were drag marks, which there weren't, and so forth. So there was physical evidence that suggested, you know, two people.
The third part of the prosecution's strategy.
One of those people was definitely Ken Bianchi. He confessed to all 10 of them, and there was other evidence tying him to a number of the victims.
From a public library pay telephone, someone called the escort service that dispatched Kimberly Martin to an apartment building in Hollywood. Detectives recovered Bianchi's fingerprints from that phone.
And then, if you believe that there's two persons, the only other person could have been Angelo Bono. And because of the relationship between the two guys and a lot of other factors that included, you know, the geography involved here. And that's how we argued the case.
In our previous episode, we recalled a key moment in the preliminary hearing.
It was a motion to dismiss based on the unreliability of the witnesses because they had been hypnotized.
Prosecutor Elizabeth Barron handled a defense motion that claimed hypnosis tainted the testimony of Bianchi and other witnesses. When the preliminary phase ended, Roger Boren didn't ask Barron to continue with the case. She felt disappointed and concerned about the optics of an all-male prosecution team.
And then there was my terrible disappointment that Michael Nash was assigned to it instead of me. 10 dead women. There should be a woman on the case. But I figured, okay, he's had enough of me.
It is something that, like, I've always known and always had to kind of process and deal with myself, you know, coming up. Being an adult, like I say, that's where I feel like I'm stuck, where I'm still just like a little girl stuck in that respect, like remembering that stuff.
This is Mika Mercado, Yolanda Washington's daughter.
I remember going through my grandmother's things and finding like my mom's death certificate and just like reading like strangulation.
She'd asked her grandmother to explain. The older woman had tried her best.
Your mom was a fighter. She was fighting for their life. They said she had so much tissue and skin underneath her fingernails where she was fighting back. And it's just like, that's a horrible way to die.
Mika told me how her grandmother had gotten a phone call from Yolanda to ask,
could she come back home? She said that she wanted to come back and be with me. And she said, yeah, Yolanda, you can come back home. And she said she never came home and she never called. She didn't hear from her. And then that's when she found out that she had died. Her last call to her mom was to tell her that she wanted to come home and be back with me. And she never made it.
It's like something I never expected, never wanted, and never was prepared for. I don't know how any person could be prepared for being part of a proceeding where you have to stand up and try to convince 12 jurors not to kill somebody.
Los Angeles attorney Gerald Chaliff headed Angelo Bono's legal defense. Chaliff knew that defending Bono would be an enormous amount of work and that he'd need another lawyer to help him.
I needed a job. Through an intermediary, I was introduced to Jerry Chaliff, who had just been appointed to represent Angelo Bono.
This is Catherine Mader. In 1981, she had just moved from Sacramento to Los Angeles. Through the legal grapevine, she heard Chaliff had taken on a big case and was looking for co-counsel.
I called him. I said, could I come down to see you? He had an office on Ocean Avenue, right across from the ocean in Santa Monica, which is a fabulous...
During that meeting, Chaliff described his checklist of requirements.
He wanted to have somebody who could devote full-time to the case, and he wanted to have somebody who had some extensive criminal law experience.
And something else.
He wanted to have a woman, obviously, to humanize Angelo Bono and sit next to him and look like she was enjoying his company.
Mader took the job and got to work. She thought the trial might last a few weeks, maybe a couple of months. It lasted 2 years.
Oh, I don't think either of us knew what was ahead.
The victims of the Strangler ranged all the way from hardened Hollywood prostitutes to students from a Catholic girls' school.
Mika Mercado sometimes wasn't sure what to think about her mother, Yolanda Washington. She wanted to feel close to the mother she never knew, but it was hard.
I have always struggled with being angry with my mother, so to speak, because I felt like she should have been at home being a mom and not partying or running the streets. There was one time somebody had said something to me when they knew about my mom, and they go, your mom was a prostitute. And it was like to be known like a daughter of a prostitute, you know what I mean?
So much of what she'd read about this case seemed one-dimensional and unfair.
I think the hardest thing for me is that whole thing, like the first victim, the black girl, the prostitute, you know, those three things being highlighted about who she was. When that's not who she was, those are labels that don't mean anything, but it's like, who cares what lifestyle that, you know, she might have had. And then you have to think, like, people don't think she was a kid. A kid. They were all kids.
The reporter Jim Mitchell frequently caught Bono's lead defense attorney, Gerald Chaliff, outside the courtroom for a comment on what happened that day.
But over the past years, Bianchi has changed his confession to the murder several times, and Bono's attorneys are convinced the jury will no longer believe him.
But I think that this case revolves around Mr. Bianchi. He created it. He's a liar. He's a sophisticated con man who will use anything and anybody to get what he wants. And in this case, he was facing certain death penalty in Washington. He knew he was a suspect in these cases, and his only way out, as he even admitted himself, was to have a bargaining tool, and that bargaining tool was Angelo Bono.
Well, we had to come up with a strategy for how we were going to defend Bono.
This is Chaliff's co-counsel, Catherine Mader, again.
One of the strategies that we had was that we knew that Bianchi had killed alone after he left Los Angeles. We know that he went to Bellingham, Washington, and we know that he killed two women without having Bono with him.
In January 1979, about a year after moving to Washington State, Bianchi, by himself, killed two women, 22-year-old Karen Mandick and 27-year-old Diane Wilder.
We had heard that there were some unsolved murders of young girls or women in Rochester. I went back to Rochester with one of the investigators.
Between 1971 and 1973, someone sexually assaulted and strangled three young girls in Rochester, New York. Bianchi lived there before moving to California. After his arrest, detectives looked into the possibility he was somehow involved in those murders. But Rochester authorities never charged him. The crimes remain unsolved.
So one of the thoughts we had, or theories that we had, that we could have presented to the jury was that Bianchi killed alone before he came to Los Angeles, and he killed alone after he left Los Angeles. So he did not need Bono to commit any of these murders.
The defense was essentially Bianchi. You know, keep the focus on Bianchi.
Prosecutor Roger Boren knew that his most important witness, Kenneth Bianchi, was also his biggest vulnerability. If the defense could undermine Bianchi's credibility with the jury, perhaps Bono could go free.
They just kept saying, you know, he's the ultimate scam artist.
But Boren figured the defense team had another problem. Their client, Angelo Bono, was somewhat repellent.
Bill Littlefield, the public defender of L.A. County, but Bill Littlefield said to Mike and me, he says, the longer this trial goes, the jury sits there seeing him, they're not going to like him.
My name is Michelle Kessler, and at the time I was not married, so my maiden name was Michelle Hawkins. And at the time of the Hillside Strangler murders, I was a criminalist with the Los Angeles Police Department, where I served for 33 years and then retired.
Michelle Kessler was among the first investigators to arrive at the quiet suburban street where a man discovered the body of Lauren Wagner one morning in late November 1977. Lauren was the Hillside Strangler's eighth victim. Kessler noted something unusual on Lauren's wrists.
Where they had taped her, they had untaped her. And there was all kinds of fibers in that tape left on her hands.
Kessler placed paper bags around Lauren's hands and watched as detectives gently placed her body into a county coroner's van. Then Kessler followed the van downtown.
Normally, they take photos, wash them down. Well, I wanted to be there before they washed the body down, so I went over to the coroner's office, and either I used ethanol or acetone, I can't recall. Probably ethanol. It dissolves, or methanol. It dissolves but doesn't dissolve the fibers. Acetone's a little rigid.
She carefully removed the fibers for later analysis.
I used a Petri dish and put it under her wrist and washed these fibers off with the liquid. And then used a little, they have a little pipette that's about this big, and he put a little suction thing on the end and drew that up and put it in vials.
When you write a search warrant, you know you're gonna have it's going to be challenged. And challenged aggressively, because that's how a lot of cases are won and lost.
This is former LAPD Detective Bill Williams. He supervised the search of Angelo Bono's home and upholstery shop.
The first thing I want, there was a desk. I went to the desk, pulled the drawer out.
Inside the desk, Williams found a leather wallet. Bianchi had told investigators that he and Bono had posed as police officers to abduct their victims, and that Bono had flashed a police badge.
It matched the description perfectly to the search warrant. It had been used to abduct girls off the street when they were playing like they were undercover cops.
The badge itself was missing, but the wallet showed indentations some object had left behind. Forensic analysis would later confirm those indentations matched the outline of a badge, and traces of metal remained in the leather. The wallet would become People's Exhibit number 35.
And the next item was the biggie, the carpet.
Bianchi told investigators that he and Bono took turns strangling most of their victims inside the house on the spare bedroom's dark brown carpet.
Because the girls had been placed on the floor, on the carpet.
A forensic technician asked Williams what sections of the carpet did he want removed.
Take the whole thing. Take the whole carpet.
The tech said it wouldn't fit in the van.
So they had to go rent a truck, come back, and they took the entire carpeting up. You know, it seemed like overkill, but I don't think there was such a thing in that case.
Detectives also removed a brown vinyl chair. Forensic investigator Michelle Kessler again.
Sure enough, they took all the fibers out of the upholstery around the edges, you know, on your couch, like you don't clean down there, and compared them to the fibers I took off Lauren Weiner.
A forensic scientist for the LAPD determined that the particular assortment of acrylic fibers collected from Lauren's hands matched a sample of fibers taken from the crevices of Bono's chair. Forensic analysis also concluded that nylon fibers found on Lauren matched the brown nylon carpet in Bono's spare bedroom, an industrial carpeting made not for homes, but for automobiles, the kind of carpeting Bono might have had access to in his auto upholstery shop. Prosecutor Roger Boren.
Without those fibers, we would not have been able to say that the murders happened at Bono's house. And if they didn't happen at Bono's house, then it could have been anybody who was Bianchi's accomplice.
So yes, we presented everything that we had that related to either of those guys.
This is Mike Nash again, a prosecutor in the Bono case.
Fiber evidence, the location where the body was found.
In addition to the evidence found on Lauren Wagner's wrists, a bit of fluff on Judy Miller's eyelid matched fibers recovered from Bono's upholstery shop. Most of the victims were discovered just a few miles from his home in Glendale, like numbers on a clock face or spokes on a wheel. And nearly all the victims had very similar wounds, ligature marks, indentations on their necks, wrists, and ankles, except for one victim.
Yolanda Washington.
Several factors set Yolanda's case apart from the others. She was the only victim who didn't die in Angelo Bono's house.
There were also some differences in the physical characteristics. Ligature marks were slightly different on her.
On the night of October 17, 1977, Ron Lemieux, the owner of a music shop in Hollywood, saw what he thought were two undercover cops arresting a woman. Prosecutor Roger Boren.
They were taking inventory that night, so they stayed extra late. And the way he described it, he's looking out the windows, and it had windows on both sides, the south side and the west side.
The man later identified the black woman he saw that night as Yolanda Washington, and he confirmed one of the men was Kenneth Bianchi.
A guy that he identifies as Bianchi accosts her, and they talk to her, and then he yells something like, Ange.
Ange, short for Angelo.
That the car pulled up, and that he looked like he arrested her and put her in the car and drove off.
But because Ron Lemieux recalled key details about that night only under hypnosis, the judge ruled he couldn't testify in the trial.
Yeah, that really, you know, really hurt that one.
Bono steadfastly denied taking any part in the killings. But prosecutor Roger Bourne is convinced they can make a case against him, relying primarily on Kenneth Bianchi's testimony.
We're not basing our case solely on Ken Bianchi. We think that the jury will be able to believe Ken Bianchi based on all of the evidence. But it's going to take all of the evidence to get a conviction in this case, and I'm confident we will.
But is Kenneth Bianchi the bulwark of your case? Could you make a case without Kenneth Bianchi's testimony?
I'm not sure that we could do that.
Kenneth Bianchi took the stand on June 23, 1982. He was the state's 200th witness. Lead prosecutor Roger Bourne.
He wore a three-piece suit. He looked like a police officer might look at his best. He sounded rather clinical in his description of what happened. He'd go through the murders themselves step by step in an organized fashion.
Before the trial began, Bianchi changed his story several times. He continued to waffle throughout his testimony.
He'd lie more in the afternoon than he would any other time. The tired he got, the more he lied.
Bourne got good at figuring out when Bianchi was lying.
You know, even when he lied, you got to know when he was going to lie, because he'd lie about things that he either didn't want to talk about or couldn't talk about. And he used the term, "I'm doing the best I can." He said that 100 times in the trial. And he can't get certain things out. There were times that I felt he couldn't have had a memory. There was too much detail, and that he was just saying what he thought probably happened. But there were times when he got to touchy subjects, when he would revert, you'd see the craziness that he did have, and he'd suddenly lie about things that you wouldn't expect an ordinary person to lie about, and yet you'd know he was lying.
In one sense, Bianchi was consistent.
He never talked about the horror of it. He doesn't want to remember that he did the murders.
Jim Mitchell reported from the trial nearly every day.
Finally this morning, prosecutor Michael Nash asked him the crucial question. The courtroom was absolutely quiet as the prosecutor asked Bianchi, "Did you participate in the homicides of those 10 girls?" After a heartbeat's pause, Bianchi responded, "I don't know." Question, in interviews with police, were you truthful? Answer, not really. Question, but you could remember Bono? Answer, in some instances. Question, were you present during the strangulations? Answer, I don't know. Question, are you lying when you say that? Answer, no, I'm not.
Bianchi said he couldn't remember exactly how he and Bono had killed their victims.
Bianchi continued to stick by his contention that while he doesn't remember the actual murders, his cousin Angelo Bono committed them with him. Somehow I remember that, he said. Everything goes hand in hand. I have certain memories that make me feel that way.
Bono's lead defense attorney, Gerald Chaliff, didn't want the jury to pick and choose which moments Kenneth Bianchi was telling the truth. Chaliff wanted them to believe that Bianchi lied about everything, his entire life, and that he was now lying about his cousin's role in the murders of 10 women.
Which is it in your estimation? Do you think he remembers but refuses to say, or does he simply not remember at all?
My own opinion has been he's always been manipulating everybody.
3 years earlier, Kenneth Bianchi had tearfully addressed a courtroom in Bellingham, Washington.
To even begin to try and live with myself, I have to take responsibility for what I've done. And I have to do everything I can to get Angelo Bono.
During cross-examination, Chaliff asked Bianchi, what was going through your mind that day? On that night's news, Jim Mitchell reported Bianchi's answer.
I don't know. I was programmed that I would cry at a certain time. Bianchi said his entire courtroom speech, including his promise to get Angelo Bono, was written for him by his Washington State defense attorney.
And said, look, yeah, he's a piece of shit, okay? The lowest piece of shit ever.
Co-prosecutor Mike Nash.
I don't know if I used that term during the trial. I probably wanted to, and I probably said it other ways. And it was pretty painful sitting there day after day listening to that son of a bitch. But there is so much that he said that's true, and that fits right in with this whole case. And that is, in fact, the case. You know, you have to have corroboration of a witness, and there's a lot of corroboration of things that he said.
Angela Bono left an impression on juror number one, the flight attendant, Penny Stanley.
And I took a very hard look at him. And I thought, viscerally, it was that sort of creepy hair on your arm, stand up on your arms kind of thing, because I'm sensitive that way. But I was trying really hard to fight that and to just stay neutral. But I looked at him really hard, and I just felt icy cold.
Bono's lead defense lawyer, Gerald Chaliff, had an answer, Catherine Mader.
The idea was that if the jury saw a woman who was seemed to be nice and young, interacting in a normal fashion with her client, then how could he be capable of doing the things he was charged with doing? That was a subliminal message that we were sending to the jurors, to humanize Angela Bono.
The way she would talk to him like this is that she was humanizing him to us.
Each day during the trial, Penny Stanley and the other jurors watched as Mader conferred with her client.
She would get close to him and talk to him, or just the way she talked to him and looked at him made him seem like a regular guy. She didn't have any fear, or she didn't move away from him.
Angela Bono was on trial for murdering 10 girls and young women. Two men presented the state's case against him. But every day in court, at his side, was a woman.
I think the prosecution was angry about it because it was something that they couldn't counter effectively.
The news reports, books, and films that described Yolanda Washington as a prostitute omitted details about her life. At age 16, Yolanda became pregnant with Mika and dropped out of high school. But later, Yolanda completed her GED. She took secretarial classes at the Sawyer Technical School in Hollywood, run by the same organization that operated a school where Lauren Wagner, another victim, took classes. News coverage of Lauren's murder portrayed her as a business school student. Most news reports didn't describe Yolanda the same way.
I didn't know much to really be able to say, to rally around. I didn't know about going to school, going back to get her GED.
Yolanda's daughter, Mika.
It wasn't told to me or placed the way the picture that you had given to me.
She sometimes depended on public assistance, but she also worked as a waitress. And she earned money sewing clothes and styling hair. As Mika Mercado began learning more about her mother's life, she discovered uncanny similarities with her own.
And with, like, with me, like, you know, I'm like, wow, I do my own hair. You know, I like to sew. I've had a lot of odd jobs.
When Yolanda Washington became pregnant, she dropped out of high school. Mika dropped out of high school to have her son.
I went back and got my GED.
There were other parallels, too.
I can't say I've never prostituted myself, not in the way that my mom did. I've never been on the street corner, but I've, you know, when I was younger, I was nice looking, and I dated guys with money and did what I had to do for exchange of money for my situation or whatnot, and then got mixed up, you know, with the bad guy, letting him, you know, influence me to do certain things.
Everything changed when Yolanda met a man in the laundry room of her building. She told her family she sold drugs for him. That man later testified in court that he dropped Yolanda off in Hollywood one night and never saw her again. Like her mother, Mika chose the wrong man as a boyfriend.
I went to jail for selling drugs for a guy when I was 20 years old. I was sentenced to 9 months in, like, county jail.
At similar points in each of their lives, Yolanda and Mika felt they were alone, with nowhere to turn.
Not feeling like I had a support system or anywhere to go. How did I do some of, like, been through some of the same exact things that, you know, she had been through? it was just so many like parallels there, you know.
Hillside is a production of Last 5% Media. This podcast was created, written, and hosted by me, Joseph Rodota. Our executive producers are Chris George and Joaquin Alvarado. Caitlin Bruce is our producer. Adam Mellion is our research director. Cheryl Duvall is our editor. Julie Checkaway and Robert Saliday served as consulting producers. Our sound engineers are Jeremy Dalmas and Craig Thomas. Craig is also our composer. Edgar Guerra designed our logo and website. Special thanks to the Center for Inquiry Libraries in Buffalo, New York, the Hoover Institution Archive at Stanford University, the Mansfield Library at the University of Montana, and the Warnke Ranch Artist Residency. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and give us a positive rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. For information about this episode, visit our website, hillsidepodcast.com. And thanks for listening.